So welcome to another episode of Groundings Podcast. I will be co-hosting it today. My name is Yasmina. I'm a writer and researcher, and I work on anti-colonial African cinema and Black women experimental cinema from the Black diaspora. And my co-host...
I'm Kadi Gandala. I'm a clinical psychology student and global mental health researcher, born in DC, raised in PG County. So I'm very excited to talk about this film with our guest, Marawi Garima, the director and writer for the new film, Residue.
What's up? Hello, everybody. Yeah, my name is Marawi Garima, Washington, DC, born and raised, and that happens to be where this film, Residue, takes place. And it's about a young man who comes home from, a couple years away to write a film, to write a script and make a movie about his neighborhood, his childhood, how he grew up. And of course, the way things are in DC, he gets home and can't recognize the place, And a lot of the folks he grew up with are really, scattered to the wind. So he's trying to figure out, where's everybody at? What happened? Pick up the pieces, but also figure out like what this new city means to him, Like and his place in it. So it was also, let it marinate as you watch the film that it was made, really out of a sense of great urgency, and I think that it contains that kind of weight within it. And it may be unique to you depending on your, film hit, what types of films you're into. But I encourage you to, just take it for what it is.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure the film, most of the production, everything was done by the time Mochella and all the protests around gentrification and the place of go-go in the city popped off, as well as some of those, fears and anxieties around what was happening with your parents' bookstore, Sankofa, with the taxes going up and everything. So like, were you back in DC during that time? And what was the experience like having this project like on the brink of being released into the world as like this was popping off
all
in DC?
Shit, right. On the brink of that whole explosion. Yeah. I mean, I was in DC since 2018. Well, we shot in 2017, again in the summer of 2018. And I've been in DC since then. I was in there, editing the film while these things kind of popped off. Of course, the tax abatement battle for Sankofa Bookstore in D.C. was major. The way the community just came out of nowhere. I mean, not out of nowhere. But they really came out, in big numbers. And I was hearing somebody tell me the other day, like, the city council really never experienced anything like that. Just like they received thousands of emails, from the community. Just like, yo, give them that tax abatement. And so then the whole Don't Meet D.C., the whole situation with the Metro PCS, white folks telling them to turn the go-go music down, really was, it was the beginning of something very beautiful in the city for us, maybe not for gentrifiers, because it kicked off this whole chain reaction of just kind of bigger and bigger, explosive demonstrations, really culminating with, this massive Mochella event. And Mochella and Long Live Go-Go is an event put on by Yadi Yadi, which really kind of galvanized people in this moment and capitalized on like this energy that was going on in the city. And so the beginning of the film was shot at Mochella because, like I said, it popped off while I was editing. I didn't know how I would use it. I just knew that I wanted to document this moment, but then also just turned out that it fit for the film too.
What you're saying shows the way that even the production of your film was already something so community oriented and something so collective, which I think really puts your film in what is a long history of like radical revolutionary militant films, which were so predicated on, the people who showed up in the film participating in making the film. We were interested to see that you didn't use any professional actors. You were really all about using people from the place to make your movie. So could you talk a little bit more about that process?
Yeah, well, first, Melody Talley, who plays the mother, LaVon, she's been in, I think a couple features before. She's a professional actor. And I think that you could tell that she brings that in a way that kind of, really, energizes the people who are in the scene with her when she appears on set. So she brought that type of energy. And Obina Nwachukwu, who plays Jay, he has done a little bit of theater and maybe a short film or two before we did Residue. But yeah, I wouldn't necessarily classify him as a professional actor at that time. So, there are other people like that. The guy who plays Mike, that's Rizzo. Darren Scott, we call him Rizzo. And Jamal Graham, Adult Dion who's in that little scene, that special scene. He has also done a little theater as well, but that's the extent of it. So yeah, like largely, you know, everybody in the film really has never acted, you know, in any kind of sustained way. Many of them never been in front of like a camera and a, you know, crew like that. Most of them, I would say. And most of them, many of them literally like pulled off the street. You know, if you're familiar with like Sankofa Bookstore, you know, it's kind of like right on Georgia Avenue. So there's a lot of traffic in and out and past it. And like, we were literally like running outside if we see kids that are right age. Cause we had to cast like almost 40 something people, you know what I mean? For the film there, you know, black folks, especially the type of black folks you're looking for in a film like this with authentic DC accent and like ways of being, are not checking, you know, these like online casting sites. Like I said, they're non-actors, you know, and to get that type of person, you had to be, you know, going from family and friends and, you know, the street. But it was dope. It was dope. You know, and the more people we got like that, the more people were recommended. And there was even moments like when Blue was getting catcalled, you know, disrespectfully by the two dudes and, you know, by the dudes in the car. Our actors who were supposed to play that part in the car did not show up that day. And so like those dudes were like walking past, you know what I'm saying, the set just when we realized like we didn't have anybody to do the catcalling. And there was just some young brothers with the mask, you know, on his head, you know what I mean? Like they just came just like that. It was like, do y'all want to be in a movie? And they were like, hell yeah, you know what I'm saying? You know, it was just like that. It was like half the people didn't ask like what the movie's about, but especially when they find out it's about DC, they're like, oh man, you can have anything you want. You know what I mean?
Yeah, how many of those do we have?
Right, right. When was the last time you seen a movie, you know, about DC, made by black people, about black people? You know what I mean? The only one I can think of previous to this is Jazz and the Diamond District. Mm-hmm. And that was 10, almost 12 years ago. You know what I mean? So yeah, I think people were certainly like excited for such an event, you know what I mean, as low-key as it was.
And I can't remember where I heard you say this, but I feel like at some point I heard you say that that whole experience kind of felt like the closest thing you could think of was like community organizing. Could you speak a little bit more to that experience?
Yeah, so you know, I can't claim, you know, community organizing roots. You know, I think that like a lot of artists find themselves kind of, you know, maybe instinctively being somewhat lone wolf types, you know what I mean? But of course, many don't, you know, but I think that there's a section of kind of artists who kind of seclude themselves from like, or isolate themselves from political, from organized political action, you know what I mean? And so that's something that I've been actively, you know, working my way out of, especially, you know, during this whole uprising 2020, which I think, you know, that happened for, I think that was a turning point for a lot of people who realized that like, yeah, there's more to it than just the art. But yeah, so I got involved in some organizing out in Chicago, and that's when I was like, yo, like this shit feels familiar, you know what I mean? Like the way we just kind of determine what it is, you know, what our objective is in a certain campaign, and then just organize people around it based on, you know, how and why it makes sense to them, you know, why they would support such a thing. And that's literally the only way Residue got made, was because people either would never have access to, you know, such a big story and, you know, kind of opportunity, you know what I mean? Or they don't come around often in DC, or, you know, and this was the majority of it, you know, people saw, you know, responded so emotionally to the story, you know what I mean? And the opportunity to bring a story about DC, especially in a time of gentrification when everybody's riled the fuck up, you know what I mean? And I think that it was kind of a no brainer, you know what I mean? That like, this is something that I could, you know, it appeared to people as an opportunity that even an ounce of their energy could actually have an impact. You know what I mean? Like once people can see that like their input would have, you know, direct output, it's easier for people to get involved because they don't feel like, you know, what can I do? You know what I mean? My effort doesn't really mean anything. But when they see even the tiniest bit of their effort moving this thing, you know what I mean? So far along, you know what I mean? Yeah, you know, it becomes like a self-sustaining kind of movement. You know what I mean? It was a little mini movement, you know what I mean, in our neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I think it's powerful too, because you put those questions inside of the film itself. Like there's that opening line about like, you know, did you think that a script would make a difference? You thought that a film could save us. Like the questions are there on the table. And then like later in the film, when he's speaking to Delonte, and he's like, I'm trying to give a voice to the voiceless. And there's an immediate pushback to that. And I think that adds a lot of weight and complexity, because you're not spoon feeding people an easy, like, just watch this film, like, it'll make a revolution. Like, you're actually putting questions there, and you're bringing, like, a community, like, into conversation with itself, not with outsiders. And, like, that's really striking as well, that it's, like, it's about gentrification, but it's not about gentrifiers and, like, how they feel and, like, them trying to feel better. It's just, like, this is what they did. They're on the side of the image. And, like, these are how the people are actually responding.
Yeah, you know, it's cool because, well, it's not cool because I went to school with a lot of folks who I felt, you know, man, you hear, you know, give a voice to the voiceless, give a voice to the voiceless everywhere you turn. You know, every filmmaker feels like they're saving the world, you know, and that they feel like, you know, film is going to be the thing that gives a voice to the voiceless, to this community that I know nothing about, except maybe I lived there for 2 years, you know what I mean? And I saw this one thing that really affected me so deeply and I'm so emotional about, and I feel that I can really save these people, you know, with this one film. That's all they need, you know what I mean? And it's like this white savior complex, which is kind of spread to people, you know, far outside of just white folks. You know, black folks get involved in the same type of thought process too, because it's like, you know, it's a bit of a, what's it called when you're in a place and everybody's saying the same thing? It's an echo chamber, you know what I mean? Film school is a absolute echo chamber, you know what I mean? Especially USC, you know, kind of like, it don't get no more kind of isolated than that. And it's weird, even if you look at USC, the way the whole institution is kind of positioned in the black community, Latino community, and, you know, in South Central, they have this gate surrounding the whole campus. They call it the Walls of Troy. You know, it's like the whole shit is oriented, you know what I mean, in a way to just kind of like view yourself as somebody who is kind of superior and able to help people and, you know, but also, you know, separate from them. And so anyway, all that to say that I was very nervous, you know what I mean? Because, like, you know, it's clear that, like, black people can be turned into agents against their own communities, you know, despite their best kind of intentions. And so for me, I was like, okay, if that's the case, then it's possible that, like, I'm going to be taking in things that I can't detect, you know what I mean? And so, yeah, like, I was really, like, skeptical of almost everything, you know, I was doing. And, you know, that found its way into the film because it was very real and, like, physical for me in that sense. But I was just, like, anxious, you know what I mean? Like, what am I doing? You know what I mean? Like, and a lot of it has not resolved itself to this day. You know what I mean? It's still playing out. There's still this whole kind of, you know, thing happening, you know, where the film is getting play, but then, like, what has it done for the community where we shot it? You know what I mean? Which is, you know, in the end, it's immaterial. It's hard to quantify, you know what I mean? Yeah, people are still getting gentrified out of there, you know what I'm saying? Like, people are still living, you know, in conditions that, like, no human being should live in, you know what I mean? Like, people are still subject, black folks are still subject to the bullshit. And in many ways, this film is launching me into my, you know, into whatever my career might turn into. And so a lot of it is up to me and, like, how I kind of maneuver in this moment. But a lot of it's, you know, like, it's up in the air. You know, like I said, it's hard to quantify. It's hard to say that, like, I was successful. But hopefully by, yeah, building these questions into the film, I would at least give people pause in other endeavors, you know what I mean? And also kind of inject this type of critical engagement into black communities around the world, you know, or around the country. Because I do believe in, like, the importance of Delonte just, you know, existing amongst all black folks to just be like, slow your roll. I don't trust you.
And, you know, that relationship between, like, the black film and the black audience, like, that's another really important one. Because, like, from the beginnings of cinema history in the U.S., which obviously started out hyper white, like, just more, I mean, it's still racist, but it was more overtly racist. And that was when black audiences started to be these sort of resisting audiences where they wouldn't just watch a film like Birth of a Nation and say, no, whatever, but they would actually, like, actively, like you're saying, critically engage with it and push back against, you know, the kind of politics that was being exposed with that. So I think that, you know, that sense of a dialogue between the film and the people watching it and the community making it, and that being an ongoing process and not just, like, an easy answer that comes out at the end, is also really important.
Yes, it's definitely ongoing. Like, it's definitely like this weird kind of dialectical relationship that's just, like, evolving over time. You know, if you look at, like you said, they're less overtly racist, but at the same time, you know, the evolution that they've gone through, you see that they're more able to get beneath the skin, you know what I mean, of Black communities and be accepted by them, but still contain, you know, equally destructive kind of ideas, caricatures, stereotypes, and all the bullshit, you know, literally to this day, you know what I mean? So I think that, like, it's also on us, you know, as like the creators and also the critics, you know what I mean, to also sharpen our tools and continue to evolve our tools of detection and, you know, kind of resistance, you know, and also our images, because it's a battle. The whole thing is a battle for sure.
And that kind of dynamic of it being like less overtly racist reminds me of the scene where they're at that like backyard party and like the white people invited them over. They probably felt super good about themselves. Like, oh, we invited the leftovers from the neighborhood over. And like there's like, I'm pretty sure there was go-go playing in the background, which cracked me up because I was like, what? Why people are in a party at DC playing go-go? And if you are, I probably trust you even less for some reason.
Yep. Yep. Oh, man. I went to a restaurant in my mother's house. Then I knew better, you know what I mean? Like, it's a restaurant that I knew what the situation was, you know, because there's like these pioneering white restaurants that like kind of, you know, punch into a neighborhood and they're kind of like the vanguard of the reaction. And basically, like, they were blasting go-go. I heard it from, you know, far away, and I was like, okay, maybe, you know what I mean, like, maybe it's some Black folks in there, you know, I don't know. We get there, it's nothing but like, you know, white folks and, you know, Caps jerseys, you know, like Black people don't even know. You know what I mean? Like the Caps, the relationship of like the Capitals to like Black people in DC is like another thing. Like, you know, when you see Caps jerseys, you're going to see very few Black people. But anyway, we get there and man, it was the most surreal thing, because it's right in the mix, like this whole kind of erasure of go-go, criminalization of go-go. So of course there's not a Black person in the restaurant, you know what I'm saying, in front or behind the counter, you know what I mean? And I was just sitting there, I just felt like, suddenly felt like you know, the animals, the game that they put up on the wall once they kill it was, you know what I mean, like you see like a deer's head, the way hunters put up their game on like wall and shit like that. That's how, yeah, I felt. What's that shit called? Taxidermy and whatnot. I really felt just like a, you know what I mean? Like I was just kind of just, that's, you know, it was this weird thing where I could see into the future where Black people would not exist, but white folks would be playing the hell out of go-go all over the city because, you know, they'll kind of body snatch the culture and remove the people, you know. It's a thing. It's definitely a thing.
The fact that, you know, they like you said, actively criminalizing and pushing go-go out the city with the Black people that are also getting pushed out. Like now we're at a point where it went down from like 70% Black to like 46% Black, and now you can hear go-go all over. It's like who's the for at this point? Yeah. Even a protest scene, like, and I love when, you know, Long Live Go-Go and them have that out there, but then you see a crowd of white people. Like, I've never seen that before in my life.
Yeah, it's about to get so bad. I don't even want to project into that future, but yeah. But I think the seeds of resistance are in go-go as well. You know, I think that like go-go music is literally like our best shot, you know what I'm saying? It's our best weapon at like really fighting back in a way that empowers us, you know what I mean? Because intensifies our sense of identity as Black DC inhabitants and the folks who built the city. And also along with it is an increased like political awareness that's also bubbling up. You know, because like, oh, they're trying to take this, you know what I'm saying? Oh, they turned down the, you know, the go-go at the Metro PCS. Then that leads you down a whole rabbit hole of questions like who did it? Why they doing it? You know what I mean? That starts to help you connect the dots about like why so-and-so had to move out. You know what I'm saying? Why are we having to?
Yeah.
It starts to kind of illuminate all these pressures that may have felt phantom-like up to that point. Now they're kind of, you know, crystallizing it, you know, like real material ways, you know what I mean? And just to say that like suddenly folks are talking about, you know, the discussion of gentrification is so much more widespread amongst the youth, for example, which to me is a major success. So I just think that like go-go contains the seeds of, you know, kind of radical reaction to radical engagement with gentrification and also just, you know, our lack of political power in the city.
And as we know, and I think exactly as you're saying, like our cultural, like Black people's cultural practices have also always been linked to political education, been linked to our forms of resistance. Like they, you know, like the separation of politics and art is always ridiculous because they're always there working together whether you want to recognize it or not. But just because you use that word phantom, I know something that both Tariq and I really appreciated was, like, the film is so much about, like, material processes of injustice and dispossession and all those things, but you have all of these surrealist elements. And we were so curious about, like, what brought you to use this sort of hallucinatory, dreamy, like, magic realist set of techniques to go with these very concrete political issues?
One, I'll just say, just into the first thing that you said, just made me think of Cabral, you know, Return to the Source. And I think that's kind of like the idea behind Gogo being a weapon, you know, for kind of what we need, you know, in this moment. But for, in terms of, like, I'll say that, like, it's important for me to push back on just the label of, like, magical realism, especially for Black films, because I think it's so easy for that type of label to kind of divorce, like, these very real and, like, material films from reality in a way that kind of helps, you know, this kind of narrative of, like, Black people, you know, normal Black conditions, you know what I'm saying, making these things, you know, extraordinary or, like, super, you know, super real rather than just, you know, our normal everyday existence, you know what I mean? And I guess I think that, like, that also is kind of tied into, like, this whole magical Negro trope. You know, if you look at, like, a lot of white filmmakers making films about Black people, a lot of times, like, the characters, you know, have to have superpowers. And not to break this down into, like, an oversimplified way, because I know you know about this, but I think that magical realism also plays into that. It's so easily applied to Black stories because our conditions do seem, you know, like, surreal and, you know, kind of extraordinary in that way. But it was never my intention, you know. And Residue, literally all I'm trying to do in the film, and if it comes out that way, it's even crazier. It's just that I'm really trying to follow the direct, you know, physical and mental experience of coming back to, you know, of Jay coming back to his city, kind of dropping into these types of conditions, you know what I mean? And I think that, like, I was really just following a feeling that I have felt, you know what I mean? And so in that way, it doesn't get more material than that. You know, to me, like, that's the crazy thing about it, is that, like, trying to draw the connection between what I remember, how the city used to look, you know, what my experiences were, and where we are now, and how the hell we have arrived at this point, does require, you know, like, these really visually and sonically intense techniques. But I do push back on, you know, kind of like some of those ways of describing them, because I want it to always be remembered that, like, this is very real and it's everybody experiencing it this way, you know what I mean? Or in ways, you know, relatable to this, you know, a Black folks experience. To me, you know, no magic is needed, you know what I mean, to kind of describe the way we experience the world, you know, or this country.
No, and I would say it absolutely comes out that way. And if anything, those visual techniques, I think, make the emotional side of it, like, feel just as real as the rest, like, that kind of trippy, like, because, like, I think memory is one of, like, the most, like, confounding experiences because of how strong it can be in unexpected ways, how it can disappear in ways that, like, you would never have imagined. And your film gives us that sense in a way that I think, like you're saying, it feels very embodied and personal to Jay as a character, but because we're seeing it visually, it also becomes this more collective sense of, I think, like, even just of displacement, which I guess from what you're saying, like, that process of returning to a place you thought you knew and you don't recognize it anymore, is like, that's how that feels. It's both familiar and so foreign.
Something that you said about, like, you coming back, and also for, like, Jay coming back, kind of makes me think of your father's film, Deza, and how, like, having someone leave Ethiopia, go for school, come back, and then trying to make sense of who they are in that place. And, like, that kind of sense of, like, leaving and coming back, and who are you and who's this place? And then, like, that, again, forced, like, displacement and lack of trust and safety in that setting. How much did that film or that larger body of work from your parents, like, influence what we're seeing now?
Oh, I mean, you know, that's where I'm at. You know, that's the wellspring which I'm pulling from, you know what I mean? And I think that, like, one, you know, it's funny, if the Garimas are specializing in anything, it's about stories of folks who, you know, went away and come back. But if you look at, like, my dad's own journey in life, you know, leaving Ethiopia at a young age, going to this foreign land to, like, you know, to educate himself in a way that would allow him to help his people, you know what I mean? And then, of course, my own journey, you know, like, a similar kind of trajectory. It makes sense, you know what I mean? I think that, like, that's kind of like a thematic through line through both of our lives, you know, in an interesting way, you know, really like real cool circular kind of way. And our films seem to be in like direct conversation, or my film seemed to be in direct conversation with, you know, with his. And I think that's so dope, man, you know, but also my mother's. If you watch her short film, Brick by Brick, what she did as a student at Howard University, man, the film predicts our situation now by decades, you know what I mean? They called it displacement back then, you know, the way it was happening in D.C., but it was so specific. But if you watch that film, man, oh, man, you know, if, especially if you watch these two side by side, it's called Brick by Brick, and it's incredible. And but you don't have to stop there. You know, there's very, you know, this parallels. She's got another film called Through the Door of No Return, you know, kind of tracing her father's footsteps. You know, her father from Mississippi. She's from, you know, she was born in Detroit, but tracing his footsteps, you know, from the South to the North and then also back to Africa. You know, there's like thematic currents that run through all three of us, you know, and through them, their parents as well. And I don't know, you know, I think that like, I studied their films rigorously, you know what I mean? I studied their work very rigorously, you know, outside of just their film, you know, their work with the bookstore, their work in the community, their work with other filmmakers, you know, and trying to, you know, develop this collaborative kind of distribution channels that they attempted, you know, in the past. And so, yeah, I'm definitely a student of all that. And it only makes sense that, you know, whenever I go to work, it just kind of flows out. It makes sense that I'm constantly referencing them.
It's interesting that you said specifically displacement too, and like these different narratives of whether you're a refugee from Ethiopia or, you know, to the door of no return, or what the different ways that people are displaced or like brought to this place and then again displaced once you found a new home.
Right.
And it reminds me of when I saw the title of the film, I thought of like by happenstance, there's this article from like the 1980s and like the Washington Post or whatever, where they ask like people or residue, and they're talking about refugees from other countries as like leftover people. Shit. Like the UN agencies that are in charge.
Yeah, send me that. Please send me that.
They directly ask like, are these like people or residual populations, the leftovers from the refugees? Like it's wild that the language keeps coming back.
Yeah. I mean, shit, look what's happening. We, you know, black folks all over the world are subject to the whims of, you know, whiteness and capital. You know what I mean? It's all just kind of like movement of capital pushing us from one place to another. And, you know, we never really have time to like barrel down and kind of develop concentrated culture over hundreds of years, you know, in the ways like European countries have been able to. And like, there's this whole thing where you're like subject to that, but, you know, it's also kind of bringing about its own problems, you know what I mean, with like the way Latin America or, you know, Central America is just like wholesale kind of taking back, you know what I'm saying, America in this really beautiful way, you know what I mean? And then also like in Europe, you know, they're not protected from like the movement of like, you know, folks from like Africa and other places in the world kind of coming back. Folks who they have displaced through their own, you know, looting and violence and destruction, you know, now coming back to like, now, you know what I mean? It's like this really amazing circular karma, karmatic transaction that's going on now. And nobody's really safe from it, of course, you know, except from like the richest, you know, white folks and, you know, stuff like that. But like, yeah, it's an interesting kind of project to track how they don't even notice, you know, the results of their own actions, you know, the consequences of their own kind of, you know.
And who they constantly, in fact, like intentionally leave out of those narratives. Like, it's that article is so wild, and it makes me think of like Angela Davis in some of her writing about prisons has called them a place where they put surplus populations. Like, it's literally, it's a container for people that you failed to give fair housing, you failed to give fair wages, you failed to take care of. And I think what also comes out really well in your film is that as specific as the story is to DC gentrification, it's also more about all the interlocking processes that oppress Black people in general, which is to say it's policing, it's incarceration, it's economic genocide, like it's the whole thing. And to your point of kind of bringing it out to the international scope, there's that scene with the parents where the mother says that she's going to run away to Cuba, and the dad is like, you can't escape it, the world is a ghetto. And it's like, yeah, like where are Black people safe? Like racial capitalism is global. There's no outside to this. Like there's nowhere to run. We have to dismantle the whole thing.
Yeah, you know, as far as we can see, you know, from this country, it seems to be nowhere to run. Yeah, sometimes you do want to run away. You know, sometimes you do want to just like go somewhere else, you know, where they respect black folks, if such a place exists, you know what I'm saying? And just kind of like, you know, do your thing. I think that like that is an option for some people. But of course, you know, there's so much work to be done at home. It is. But then also, yeah, you really can't run from it, you know, because where in the world are black people really, you know, respected or safe anyway? Also, the greatest amount of work, you know what I mean, for us who know this country so well, you know what I mean, we could do so much kind of right here where we are, you know, this place which kind of projects misery to black folks all over the world, you know.
Like, we know that a movie is not going to bring down a fascist government, but we also know that when you're sitting in a situation where, you know, the options in front of us are no good, art and like cultural practices like do have a role in like sparking those mechanisms of imagination, of asking different questions, because, you know, we're not going to policy our way out of this. Like, we'll know that. Going back to what you and Tariq were also talking about, that, you know, the question of having to tell our own stories and like being in charge of narrating our own histories. I know I read somewhere that you kind of considered this to be a way to document Q Street. Like, can you talk a little bit about that? Like what that documentary impulse was for you?
Part of it is like, you know, trying to imagine, you know, the extent of my abilities, you know, what I can actually do with such a project. And like, what are the things that I know I can do rather, as opposed to what are the things which are, you know, kind of immaterial. Like, I know with a recording device, you know, I can record the people I know, the people I grew up with who are still around or still alive. You know what I'm saying? I can get the places on camera, you know, I can get photos, I can get footage, I can the living rooms, you know, the photos on the walls, the, you know, very specific and unique ways that I grew up. In like super kind of selfish way, you know, we went in and did not change a thing. You know what I mean? We didn't have production designers. We shot each house as it was, because it's like, I want to remember, you know, I want to have a record of like what this house, which I grew up in, what it looks like, you know what I mean? Like how they so painstakingly kind of production design their own house, you know, with the photos and the arrangements and furniture and all that stuff. Specifically like Abuela's house, you know, the woman singing to the baby. That's my man, Nick. That's my man's house. Every weekend I'm over there, you know what I'm saying? I wish the cameras could record. I wish there was like a smell recording device, because even the way like that house walking in, you know, the aromas and all the ways, you know, that like that's a very specific and like warm, you know, memory, which brings me so much peace. You know what I mean? And it's only really specific to me, but I would like to record those details, you know, as painstakingly as I can, because in the end, the rest, you don't know what the film will accomplish, you know, but you know what photographs accomplish, you know what recordings of people accomplish for you personally. You know what I mean? You're happy to see that person in a photo or hear their voice in a recording. To me, that is a major accomplishment compared to the alternative, which is complete obliteration. You know, I just felt like at the very least, we can be sure of this, regardless of where the film might go. You know, especially coming kind of from the type of training I come from, which is really the festival circuits and the awards and, you know, all that stuff is really secondary to the cultural work and the personal emotional work.
That, like, one of the things that you said about, you know, about that house and thinking about all the things that reminds for you, the smells, the sounds and stuff. And, you know, for me, it things that stood out were like seeing the Abishak Emmys is like, you know, Ethiopian clothes and just like, all right, I wasn't expecting that. But and you've spoken before about the connection between, you know, your mother's lived experiences in your neighborhood and the areas around and the occurrences and residue. So like, thinking about all that, how do you see this film as a reflection of like the women in your life that you know?
Well, first about the Kemis, I didn't tell her to wear that. Yeah, like, you know, that's Mama Hasanatu. She is an incredible, you know, DC cornerstone, you know, of the community. Everybody knows her. She, you know, she's one of those folks that, like, you know, she was in Sankofa. She's the woman who puts the rifle on the slave master at the end. She's the one telling the story about Nunu. You know what I'm talking about?
Yo.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's what I mean. Like, that's the layers of, like, DC that is embedded in this project. And thank God. She was so happy to be in another guerrilla film, as she said it. You know, this is terrible, you know, sad news. she was battling cancer through the whole thing, you know what I mean? She passed away right after we finished filming, you know what I mean? So to me, like, you know, so when I say it was an urgent process, that's what I mean, you know what I mean? Like, we don't know what could happen. Everything went wrong, you know what I mean, in the course of it, but like, what we managed to get is a miracle. Regarding the women in my life, man, I gotta go one by one, you know, like, so the scene with the woman's dog shitting on the lawn happened in real life too, man, just like that. I walked outside. I was struck. I was like, yo, what is happening? You know, I was just like, I was literally like paralyzed with shock. And my mom, who knows the drill by now, she just, with the swiftness. And literally, like, that was her line. Like, even when you clean that shit up, it still leaves a residue. And I was like, it's like, who is up there gifting me right now for this script? You know what I mean? Nah, you know, my mother is the person who I see with both hands, you know what I'm saying? Like tussling with this beast of gentrification, you know what I mean? So with such energy and passion, you know, endless, you know, renewed anger, you know what I mean? And indignation, even at times when I'm not sure to be angry at something, it's really her cues that I'm following, you know what I mean? And so I think that like following her into this battle has been like the, if there's a type of radicalization that applies to gentrification, that is kind of the process, how it's been for me. It's like watching my mom deal with this, you know, my father too, but like really my mom. And I told you she did that film Brick by Brick. So she has the tools from a long time ago, you know what I mean? It has been tracking this whole process in really incredible ways. And it is not, you know, divorced from what you saw with the tax abatement thing, you know what I mean? She's really cornerstone of the Sankofa Bookstore Community Center, you know, and sees the importance of it as a kind of, you know, shield against this wave of gentrification, you know, for at least a few people, you know what I mean, or some segment of the community. Her and my father are unified kind of in this thing. But when I tell you that, like, you know, it's really kind of watching her battle these, you know, this monstrosity, you know, that's kind of, that's why her character was important, you know. When Jay comes in with the pink slip, you know what I mean, it's like, it's her kind of like notifying him, you know, kind of like cueing him as to the battle that he's stepping into. And his dad is kind of on the side making jokes, of course, got his own feelings, but like, you know, it's really the mom. And it's also her who is kind of gauging, you know, his own intensity. You know, she's the one like, you know, don't fall for the decoys, because he sees what's going on. He, in a way, overreacts, you know, in that moment, maybe, I don't know. But like, it's her who's like tempering him for the battle, the sustained battle, you know, because like she's been in it for a long time. You know, she has the endurance, you know, has developed the endurance to be able to last this long, because you will burn out. You can burn out. To really say don't fall for the decoys, which is a critical lesson or warning, which, of course, he doesn't hear totally. I just think that she kind of plays this important role of like example, but also, you know, kind of like, yeah, you know what I mean? I think I see what I'm saying.
Black mother is like, honestly, like,
man, that is, hey, listen. It's, I also have to, like, you know, it was really that kind of interaction. This whole decoys thing was also a line from real life. Maybe I'm just not creative at all. You know, I'm just copying shit down as it happens. But yeah, she was the one that kind of took me to the side. And it was that moment for me of like choosing the path of like making this film and like not falling for the decoys, you know, doing something productive so I can attack the root rather than fall for these jokers. You know what I'm saying? That was critical for me. Of course, it was important for me to also follow the path that I didn't follow, you know, in the film, at least, you know, film form, kind of follow that journey, you know, with Jay. When it comes to Blue, you know, this is another like interesting process, you know, of like making this film, because Blue, in many ways, she's not from DC. She's kind of secondhand getting the stories of the city through, you know, Jay's kind of experience of like kind of seeing him go from place to place. But in many ways, you know, like, we don't know much about her. You know, she's a mysterious character. She kind of comes in out of nowhere. And, you know, he kind of drops her, you know, in that scene at near the end. And it's really kind of like, you know, fucked up way. But the process of, like, writing her and, like, making this film over the course of, like, 2 years is a process also, like, of, you know, crystallizing, you know, my own immaturities as a young man, you know, into this project. You know, she, I think, is, you know, somebody that like Jay could potentially build a relationship with, you know, potentially like a strong relationship with. But, you know, the idea is that every chance he gets, you know, to like rise to this kind of occasion, you know, is interrupted by like shit that's happening in the city, which I think is important for me as well. you know, to like really kind of show, you know, when she's like, yo, what's up? I'm about to just dip because you're clearly not, you know, not putting in on this. And then the whole shit with Mike happens, you know, just as he's about to like, you know, extend himself. Because like, for the most part, you know, we are underdeveloped in many ways, emotionally, Black men specifically, you know what I mean? I think that like, it is a process, a incredibly layered process. And part of it is the fact that like, we are underdeveloped, really in our attempt to kind of survive the situations that we, you know, kind of exist in the city. And that's not to like, you know, change the blame or anything like that, but to say that like, this is something that happens. But at the same time, you know, it's also like a character who I felt like, you know, would at the very least be somebody that like people watching the film, young men watching the film could kind of see how we destroy, you know, these good relationships in our lives, how we act when we're in our immaturity. I think the end result is, you know, she's somewhat underdeveloped, you know, in terms of like a fully, you know, kind of fleshed out character in the film, partially because Jay's not paying attention to her anyway, you know what I mean? But also partially, like I said, because of my own insecurities. And I think that like, or my own kind of underdevelopment. And it was, I'm sharing this with you because I think it's important to kind of see, you know, share this part of the process, you know, to say that like, there were many times I would try to walk back things that I had written into the script as I'm developing as a man, you know, trying to impose my new maturity onto the script, which I wrote years ago, you know, in the edit, in the pickup shooting, and like everything I tried to force onto the project, you know, to make her, you know, like a less, you know, a better, more, you know, fully fleshed out character. The film was rejecting, you know what I mean? It was clear and obvious, you know what I mean? And my attempts were just like everything I added on, I had to walk back, you know, and remove it for the sake of the story to go in the direction that it was originally intended. And I just think that that's such a beautiful reflection of the process itself, which is a collection of these really imperfect, you know, circumstances, you know what I mean? And you have to fold it all in. It's a snapshot in time and you have to allow it to be what it is. You know what I mean? That was the film kind of teaching me these lessons, you know, really let it be what it is as a reflection of me and the time that we were filming in.
Which I think kind of returns us to what we were talking about at the beginning, that the question, the process, all of that gets folded into the film. Like it doesn't try to erase like complexity or contradictions, because that's also very much how we experience the world day to day, is trying to make sense of the present, trying to make sense of the past, like the way memory weaves through all of that. And something that was occurring to me too, as you were like walking us through those two characters, is also that the film is also kind of not about the spectacular elements of Black dispossession and gentrification. Like it's much more about the kind of like micro everyday occurrences, which I think that's what can kind of get lost when Black suffering is such a spectacle to be thrown around the news, like for people to look at and not do anything. And then what also gets forgotten there is that this is a lived everyday experience. And I think a scene that works so, so well is the one where Jay and Delonte are speaking and then a cop comes off screen and you can just see the blue light of the police siren. And to me, that was such like, because I think that's the problem, is that policing, the carceral system, like they infect everyday aspects of everyone's life. Like you can't, like especially the lives of Black people, like you can't, it's not just a news item. It's not just a terrible thing that happened to you one year. It's there literally day in, day out. And obviously I don't want to map anything onto your film, but I think from just my reading of it, like that's the kind of work that pushes us towards like abolition, towards like actually like seeing outside of these systems, because you can't, you know, you can like destroy an organization, but you can't destroy the political ideologies that make it exist. And that's a much harder work. And I think those questions are there in the film.
And there's also this thing of like, exactly. You get so caught up in the spectacle of the horrific violence that they cause, that your ability to kind of get past that and imagine, you know, even the other aspects of those interactions. Every scene with the police officer, you know, Black people in the film nowadays plays out in just about the same two or three ways. You know what I mean? That's because, you know, we focus on like the most horrible aspects, you know what I mean? Or the most conspicuous aspects of these horrible kind of interactions. So our imagination is limited in many ways. although I can't, again, I'm retroactively, you know what I'm saying, mapping this onto into 4 years younger me, you know what I'm saying? Because at the time it was really like, I was writing that scene, I was like, I know I'm not gonna have no money for a cop car or officer's uniform and stuff like that. So like, let's, you know, do it this way. And that decision got sweeter with time as I realized like what it was, you know, kind of like allowing us to do and explore, you know, which is kind of scary to think, you know, if we had money for our first film, we would have got the cop in the cop car because we could. And me and my cinematographer talk about it all the time, Mark Jeevaratnam, Sri Lankan brother. That's my absolute brother. You know what I mean? Like, actually he's Sri Lankan and Filipino. You know, we met like a couple of weeks before the film started, and he didn't become a cinematographer until like 2 or 3 days before we started shooting. But anyway, this is a brotherhood like forged in the flames of like trying to shoot this film with nothing, you know what I mean? Over, you know, however long it's been. We talk about it now in retrospect, you know, just like, whew, thank God we ain't had no money. And like, how do we remember these decisions making, you know, the state, our state of mind in making these decisions so that when we do have money, if we have money for another project down the line, that we don't just do something just because we can, you know what I mean? He says it a lot. Like, are we doing it because we can? Or are we doing it because that's what the story, you know, wants, you know? And it's major, you know, if you think about like people's second film, third films, and like directors down the line, and you wonder if they could ever go back to like having no money, you know, because you get so used to making, you know, films with like a certain budget. And like, you know, I want to retain the instincts, you know what I mean? These instincts, of course, develop new ones, but I want to retain these, you know, as best I can. So it's definitely something I think about a lot.
And I think from what I understood, that's the same reason why you don't have whole body white people. You just have body parts, right? But that also, because I think another really striking scene is the one where there's these white women having brunch and you just see their feet. And then that is one of those scenes where, you know, it gets a little bit beyond the normal events and there's that blood pooling underneath, which I don't obviously know, but you can share with us like what the intention was behind that. But I think the effect that it at least had on me was that she's like, oh my God, this is talking about indigenous genocide. Like, this is showing blood pooling out from stolen land. Like, this is making a connection between gentrification and colonialism. But I think that's also the beauty of, again, like having a more collaborative process-oriented perspective of something like cinema, is that it's not only the ideas that the director has before it's made, it's the stuff that happens that's unexpected, it's the stuff that people from the community bring to it when they see it, it's the stuff that like any random person when they watch it on Netflix thinks of.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because you can only think about gentrification so much, you know, talking about take our city back so much before you start to think about like how we got here, who was here before we came, you know what I mean? And I think that obviously very quickly, you know, you start thinking about like the Native Americans who were here before we ever stepped foot, you know? And I think that like, that's always been something on my mind and it, you know, it's crystallizing into its own kind of story. But for here, for Residue, the basic idea is, you know, that even the land is rejecting them, you know what I mean? It's just kind of like in the whatever way it can, you know? And I think that like, and my cinematographer again had an interesting take that, you know, the land was so full of, you know, blood and death and, you know, overflowing. I think that like growing up in the States, let me know if it's the same for y'all, but like, you're like, okay, I know the Native Americans, you know, like white folks genocided Native Americans to like create this country. And like, you know, there's still like a few Native Americans in the country, but like for the most part, the idea is like, we're just going to keep moving on, you know what I mean? And not really address that shit. And I was a full ass grown ass man when the thought, you know, or I heard somebody speaking in a way that was like, actually, nah, you know what I mean? Like, this is still a thing that needs to be addressed and actually must be addressed, you know what I mean? If we're gonna, you know, make any type of progress in this country, you know? So like this idea of like decolonialization is so powerful to me, you know what I mean? It's so amazing to me, especially in the ways where you start to, you know, think about like, how does it intersect with like, you know, Black liberation struggle, you know? And I just think that is such an exciting topic, you know what I mean? And such like a necessary, but like, scary is not the word, you know, it's just like, you know, Irondale Roy's got this book, the title is Things That Can and Cannot Be Said. And that line for me is so beautiful, because sometimes you start thinking in directions where you're like, am I even supposed to be thinking about this type of stuff? You know what I mean? Which is such an incredible kind of arena to be in, you know what I mean? Imaginatively. Yeah, you know, the shot itself, I wish, you know, that, yes, it would have been nice to have more money for, you know, kind of like this idea. But we did that, you know, with like a shoestring budget. And I'm so impressed with the way it came out. Leeshawn AZ, our assistant director, kind of rigged that joint up with like some IV bags and, you know, like this whole thing come from the ground in like three different places. You know, it was like timed at the right time. We only had one take.
It's not just the past too, because even thinking about now with like COVID, especially like every time we see health things on disparities, especially from the CDC and stuff like that, they will bring up, at first they didn't want to, but even now they'll bring up what's happening to Black people and like, you know, Hispanic people and stuff like that. But Native Americans, they're experiencing very much the same thing, especially near reservations, but they don't even show up in the data. Oh. They're not even concerned that it's happening.
Nope. It's batshit crazy. It's batshit crazy. But of course, you know, the parallels with like Israel and all that kind of stuff. You see why it's so important that they conduct themselves in this way, you know, and they meaning, you know, the white folks who run this country.
This talk kind of about violence that's happened here makes me think about, you know, the scenes where Jay has opportunities essentially to exact violence and doesn't and does, and how that relates with police and essentially like when, for who, and like when is violence considered legitimate, like who has a monopoly on that, and like when isn't it, and the fact that like you talk about the decoys and like there's like a system, so like going up and beating that white person up about the poop on the lawn won't do anything maybe, right. Yet, you know, the end of the movie is essentially it's not that.
Yeah, like very few people have been like, he shouldn't have done that. You know what I mean? Or have been like, I don't understand why he did that. Sometimes they'd be like, he shouldn't have done that. But very, very few people are like, I don't understand why he did that. And I think that like that's kind of the idea. You know what I mean? Like, you know, if he didn't, you know, he's kind of resigning himself to like this dehumanizing kind of existence. You know what I mean? Which we do every time that we don't act. You know, we kind of die a little bit inside, you know what I mean? Because we're suppressing really the full humanity of our reactions, our emotions, and, you know, kind of thing. So we kill that part of ourselves, you know, the ability to be angry. White folks can be as angry as they want, you know what I mean? They have access to the full range of human emotion. Black folks, really, you know, we, you know what I mean? Like, I can't, it's hard to even imagine a place where like Black folks can exercise even half of their, you know, range of, as humans. So for me, the idea is that, like, you know, we got to take back that spectrum, you know, which has been suppressed, you know what I mean? Anger, which is, of course, the main one, you know, and that is righteous. It's okay to be angry, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's literally like, it is okay to be angry at, like, the things that are happening to you and other Black folks in this country. Because I think we get to the point where we suppress it so much that we start to suppress it for other people as well. Like, don't show your anger, don't be angry. So I think that, you know, despite the consequences, it has to be an emotion that we give ourselves access to or start to tangle with in a reclamatory kind of way. Is that a word?
Make it a word.
The word now.
Reclamatory justice.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's one of those phrases that gets tossed around all the time, but I think with good reason, like the Baldwin thing about how being Black in the U.S. is being in a constant state of rage, because in fact, and like the only reason that anger would not come out is because it's being disciplined by whiteness, because it's threatening, because Black people should take their oppression and say thank you, like not react against it. Yeah, and I think like showing a full scope of emotion, because, you know, as we know, like, a revolution can't be carried on emotion only, but emotion is part of the mechanisms that lead us to action. So it's there, and we need to use every weapon, every tool at our disposal, like the ones that are organized, the ones that like come out in the moment. Like we need all of them.
Yeah, and it's also a part of the work of reclaiming our humanity is, you know, diving into these emotions which have been suppressed, kind of like Tariq, which you were saying, who has a monopoly on these things. It is by, you know, having a monopoly on them and denying them to us that they have also kind of suppressed sections of our humanity, you know, have made, you know, dehumanized us. And really in reclaiming these emotions is how we kind of rehumanize, you know what I mean? We start to engage with our full humanity, you know, our conditions.
thinking about the emotions, like in this context, the two characters that probably were some of the most interesting interactions to watch was with Jay and Delonte. Because I mean, there were many feelings happening in between those interactions, and that's another case where like you're watching Delonte feel what he's feeling, and like for some reasons you're like, oh damn, because you want this relationship to work out. He's coming home. This is the protagonist, but also this is very justified that like, especially with what's going on around you, like who is an agent for a change in a good way, and who's basically an op? Like,
yeah. That's a day-to-day question. Who's an op? You know what I mean? Are you an op? You know what I mean? Like that's part of like living in America as a black person. You start to look at people, you're like, you know what I'm saying? Like, how much should I say right now? Yeah, but also, yeah, I think that like sometimes people are like, oh, I didn't really like the protagonist too much. You know, I think that like if the protagonist was like so likable, one, I think it'd be, you know, flattening kind of way to write a character. But two, it'd be hard to really relate to Delonte. You know what I mean? Like Delonte is coming with some real shit. You know what I mean? Like I think his character is so important. His character is so critical, you know? And I think it's the interplay of those two characters that really make the film. The film really comes alive when Delonte steps into the mix, you know, and him and Jay start, you know, interacting. Even though essentially that scene in the alleyway, that reunion scene, and he's asking about Demetrius, it's kind of a repeat of the scene where he's asking the old heads about Demetrius. But now in this new kind of with this other character, you know, and the idea that he might know, you know what I mean? That he knows and is not telling him, you know, even though they're best friends, you know, I think that that's when the film comes alive. But yeah, Delonte really brings some righteous, you know, indignation and suspicion with him. It's hard to not relate to him.
And he's still looking out for him too.
Still his man. Yeah.
And when we're talking about memory, it's really interesting too, because there's that scene where he's telling him about him and all of the other kids from the neighborhood go into his house, and he's just like, I don't remember that. But that was such a big part for like, that was an emotional part for him. Like he was really like reliving that childhood memory, and it was nothing to Jay.
Yeah. Which is also like what makes Jay think he could tell it better than Delonte. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, that is the line that stuck with me through the movie was, nigga, who voiceless is like, is the like the delivery, the message, I mean, everything.
Every time I seen somebody at USC talking about, let's give a voice to the voiceless, that's all I ever wanted somebody to say. Whoever they go to film, I just wanted somebody to say that to them.
I think that makes a really important point too about like both on a community level, that like especially a community of like whatever category of, you know, marginalized or, you know, whatever, people need to be empowered to allow people to come into their community and to other people say, no, like you can't come here. This is our space. And I think in the same way, that idea of voicelessness, sometimes it's that, you know, a people, they don't, it's not that they aren't able to speak themselves, is that they don't want to. And that's also a choice. Like that idea of like opacity, of also being able to go under the radar, of not owing the state your full transparency, because like honestly that's fed behavior. Like you need to give me all right. The information. And I think the film is also coming across how that becomes a complicated thing from the second that you step out of the place you grew up in. Like you lose a little bit of something in that, and it's not, you know, it's like it's not something to just mourn, but it's something to work through as a process.
Yeah, and exactly. It's going on. Everybody's got to tell their own story. You know, like the story of Q Shooter is not told. You know, it's not complete. You know what I mean? There are people who were there when I wasn't there who could tell much more and round it out and round it out and round it out and round it out. White folks are afforded that opportunity to tell so many sides of like these same stories over and over again without people being like, oh, I'm tired of those stories. I'm tired of Abraham Lincoln films. I'm tired of so-and-so films. It's really black folks. We get one shot to tell one story about one thing, you know, and that's it. You know, that's the monument to that place. But I think that, yeah, the idea is that it's incomplete. Delonte should be enabled, should be uplifted to tell his side of the story. Of course, chances are he won't be, you know what I mean, because of the country that we live in. But like the idea is that, you know, one, every community should generate its own storytellers, you know what I mean, what conditions necessitate it. But that's not the case. The case is white folks who cannot come close to our ability to tell our own stories are able to come and tell our stories before we can, because they have the resources to do it before we can. And so, you know, I don't know, man, hopefully, like, you know, the idea of this community-based filmmaking, which of course I did not start, you know what I'm saying? I'm really just drawing, like you said, you know, I'm in a long tradition of folks, you know, from my parents to all their contemporaries. LA Rebellion was literally, how do we make films with no money? High production value, you know, with no money. But anyway, like if this idea can kind of spread, you know, to the point where, you know, it's more normal. It's not just happening every 10 years, you know, because if you look back, you know, and where we shot, there's a few people in the neighborhood and the community who know a little bit about sound now, you know, a little bit about how to set up a camera, a little bit about how to run a set. You know, there's like a little, you know, filmmaking residue kind of in the area. And if another film came on top, it would grow, you know, more and more until like you develop like a film culture in a place. And so imagine that, you know what I mean?
And you kind of see, I mean, Jay essentially is doing some of this in the sense that like he has to ask so many people to piece together the answer to one seemingly simple question, which is, where is my friend that I haven't seen in forever?
Right.
Like the closest he got is he's out in Maryland somewhere.
Right. Yeah. And the answer to which kind of holds the whole key to what has happened to the neighborhood anyway. You know what I mean? Like it's part of the whole equation.
And that it's not, no one person would have that answer. Like it's a community question. Like everyone has little bits of information, and like the only truth you can get to is a kind of collective one, but it's not, it doesn't fall into one perfect piece. Like it's always a little bit fragmented. There's always bits missing, but that's the work you have to do.
He might as well be asking, where did my community go?
I have one very much more surface question.
All right, go for it.
That takes us all the way back to the beginning before we leave.
Ah.
Why did you choose Roll Call for the song?
Oh, man. First off, Roll Call, you know, is the absolute anthem. You know what I mean? Oh, man, when that joint came out, yeah, hell yeah. Everybody want to learn how to beat their feet. You know, like, it's just like, yeah.
You see Jay trying.
Right. Right. But nah, you know, Roll Call, one is the anthem, but truth be told, I was trying very hard to kind of secure go-go bands, you know, for the film. Anybody who's interested in like either doing some original score or, you know, letting us really, you know, purchase the rights to some of the film music for the film. And I reached out to many bands, you know, a lot of them, you know, I think it's hard to get their attention, you know, when you're, you know, you don't have a big name and like following and all that kind of thing. So that's what happened. You know, we just didn't get a lot of play. And this is the story of, you know, music for the whole film. I could just walk through it. It was Black Alley, Cam, you know, who's their manager, who was the first to be like, oh, you making a film about DC? Whatever you want, you know what I'm saying? You got it. So they just kind of opened their whole thing to us, you know. So it's their music, Kim Wasabi is the music that happens through the concussion sequence. And then after that, I guess I was just feeling myself. So I went back, you know, reaching out to folks, to bands that I was sure would never answer. Of course, like CCB, you know, like hit them up. Yeah, like they was like, no problem, you know. And I think also by this time, Slam Dance had happened and we had a little bit more weight behind us, you know, with the potential of a Netflix release. And that was also, I think, a big pull for folks. And so, like, before CCB came on board, TCB came on board. So that's how we got Bounce Beat Song in the beginning. And then CCB came on board, and that's how we got Roll Call. To me, looking back, Roll Call is the perfect way to open the film. But I think it was important that, like, it happened in this order, because I think that if we just kind of came to them out of nowhere, it would have been hard to, like, you know, kind of get people on board. But it worked out perfectly. It worked out perfectly, yeah, for sure.
Thank you for joining us.
Yeah. my pleasure.
We want the people to be able to find your film and find you. So if, in closing, you would just tell them where the film is, tell them where you are.
So the film is on Netflix. Residue is on Netflix, thanks to Ava DuVernay and Right Now. We didn't get a chance to talk about them, but I always want to shout them out because they're so incredible. They're historic, you know what I mean? Like, they are literally like a page of Black film distribution, which did not exist, you know what I mean, before, you know, recently. And so big ups to them for being in place and operating at such a high level to kind of take on the film in the way that they have, and really champion us in a beautiful way. And then you can find me on socials, Gerima_gang, GERIMA _gang. And if you come there, like, you'll see, you know, that's the film's page, and also everybody who's involved is kind of all over my page. So yeah. We'll be right back.